This is Climate Justice, Y'all, a podcast dedicated to lifting up and centering the climate and environmental justice movement in the South. Despite the South being the most biodiverse, diverse, and one of the largest economic engines in the world, we are underfunded and often barred from the decision-making table. Because of that, we decided to pull up a chair and amplify the stories of communities in the South that are hit the hardest by the climate crisis. We're going to use good old-fashioned storytelling to shine a spotlight on these Southern leaders from all walks of life, putting in their blood, their sweat, and their tears to transforming this region. The usage of y'all in the title is on purpose. We are honoring our Southern heritage of creativity, resilience, and ingenuity. Climate justice, y'all. It's real, it's here, and it's about time we listen to stories like Joe Womack, who is from Mobile, Alabama, specifically Africa Town. Let's get started. I'm not gonna lie to you, last week I spent maybe like an hour or two just reading about Africa Town because it has such a rich history. And I can't wait to hear more from you, but let's get started with, tell us about yourself. Who are you and why did you join this environmental justice fight?
Well, I really didn't know I was joining an environmental justice fight. I just had some things that I saw that needed to be done. I graduated from high school in 1968 and went to college. And I got back to Mobile, I guess, and settled after a short stint in the Marine Corps, active duty. And about 1974 or so, 1975. And so from about 1975, really, until about 2010, maybe 28, 2010, I was like most people in Mobile, especially those that knew about the community. I stood by and let things happen and watched them happen. And I would say, well, why don't somebody do something about that? Why is this politician up here lying? I know he's lying. And you know, and I would go, you know, I only live really about 15 miles from Africa. When I got out of the Marine Corps and came back, was I lived with my mother and I got this pretty good job working at a chemical company and making a lot of money. And when I first got back, she said, well, you know, you stay here, just save up your money. And that's what I was doing, saving money, eating her food. And she said, look, you're making a lot of money and you're eating up my food. Get out of here. and so pretty much, that's what I did. But, you know, that's my community. I loved it, grew up there, and my church is still there, and, of course, my mother's there, and my relatives, other relatives, close relatives are all there. So I go there all the time, at least 3 to 5 times a week. I just ride out there, and sometimes I just ride around. And I saw the thing deteriorating, and pretty much didn't do much about it. I've often said that the life work that I've done sort of prepared me for what I'm doing now. I was in the Marine Corps, an officer, 20 years active in the reserve. And so the main thing with a Marine Corps and an officer is leadership. And then they'll tell you, if you can't lead, you can't be here. You got to go. Because you're an officer, you can't follow. You got to lead. When I got off active service, I got a job at a chemical plant. It was originally Shell Chemical, and then they eventually sold it about maybe 12 years after I got there to DuPont. And so I got the experience in chemical business. I know what the businesses do. And then after that, I went to the trucking business, and I know what the trucking business does. And so all those three things have come in very handy in the things that I now do. In about 2008, there was a meeting called within the community. And with Africa Town, I've always heard all my life, all they want to do is get rid of everybody and turn this into an industrial conflict. Because we're surrounded on three sides by water. And so I grew up fishing and hunting and all that stuff. And most of me and my buddies, we did too, and I did that with my granddad a lot. He was the real sportsman. And so my mother called me and said, But she knew I had been in the trucking business. And this was after I had retired, started looking for something to do, keep me busy. And she said, go out there to that meeting and find out what's going on. And don't you let them take my damn land.
Yes.
And pretty much that's what I've been doing ever since. And of course, that's my community. Like I said, I love it. Now I went to that community, and that was a trucking company that wanted to move into the community. That was a lot of open area. And they was telling all the people the good things about the trucking company. And they were talking about jobs, and the politician was talking about jobs. Well, I knew that if you had a CDL, you get a job anywhere driving a truck. I don't care if trucking headquarters is located in Pullman, Oregon. You can drive their trucks located in Mobile, Alabama. And so if you just you don't have a CDL, the only job they have to offer is cleaning up their bunkhouse or cleaning up their trucks. And that's less than minimum wage most of the time. And then trucks running in and out and idling all the time, and diesel fuel and gasoline. And the worst part of it is drugs and prostitution. And so the people in the community have always been leery anyway of different businesses that won't come in and rezone. Because when you rezone something, that's it. You're not going to get it back. That's like giving away land. And over the years, we've had a lot of people to move out because of industry and because of loss of jobs and stuff. And so where at one time we had about 10 to 12,000 people in the community when I was a kid, now we got about 2,000 people. But the land is still there and it's available. And so that's what the business people look at. And unfortunately for us, a lot of the land that surrounds the community is still owned by those people that brought over to this country the last shipment of slaves to come into this country. And they're business people. And they make the land off their money. In that meeting, the community voted them down, and Mobile has what I call some very family-friendly zoning ordinance that they are now trying to change. Unfortunately, we're fighting that because when you and I see water, we want to swim and recreate and fish and all those good things. But when a businessman see water, he say, oh, that's a good place for me to put my business. But they like to locate by water. Fortunately, a lot of the environmental laws have changed. But, you know, when Africatown was founded and when a lot of those businesses moved in before the 90s, that really was the EPA hadn't even formed back then. And like I like to tell a lot of people, back in the 20s and 30s, our community, most people in our community, black folks, couldn't, you know, they were discouraged to vote, and they had no real voice. And so that's what I've been trying to do, lend a voice to the community, for the people, to fight against what we call environmental injustice, taking the land from the people. Because we believe that with the rich history of the community and that the world want to know, now is the time that cultural tourism is really big, and it's big for a lot of different reasons. And we have something that's very unique. There's only one place in this country where the last shipment of slaves landed, and that's right here in Africatown in the city of Mobile, Alabama. And we need to promote that. We've always known where the first shipment of slaves came in, Port Comfort, Virginia, 1619. We need to know where the last shipment of slaves came in. And I've been to Port Comfort. I've been to Williamsburg, Virginia, and that's a big tourism spot, and they promote the history. And that's a history that we think that that the world wants to know about. Now when I got into what I call the fight for environmental, I mentioned the trucking company. That was just the beginning, because right after that, the Mobile Chamber of Commerce and other politicians had agreed to pretty much turn Africatown into a hub for shipping tar sands to the rest of the world. That's a form of oil. It comes way out of Canada. you hear about these pipelines coming through the west and the north, but there's a pipeline coming down the east coast, but it's not in pipes, it's in rail cars. And the plan was bring it down to Mobile, Alabama and Pascagoula, Mississippi, and ship it out to Asia primarily because they have no source for oil. And that would have put a bunch of storage tanks and wiped out 75% of Africa power. And so, you know, as any good military man knows, you know, if you're going to fight a struggle, first thing you got to find out is what you got to fight with. You know, well, what kind of weapons, what kind of bullets I got, what kind of knives I got. I got to fight, man. Give me something to fight with. And so we sit around and we figured out the best weapon we had was the community and his story. The story. Nobody knew about us. No, you know, nobody cared about a community that wasn't doing anything and just dying out. But we had to convince the world that we were worth saving. You know, you can't get rid of this community. It's a community where the last shipment of slaves came in. How can you dare, dude? How can you get rid of this? You get rid of this, that's gone. You know, they're only, I don't know if you don't know anything about Rosenwald schools after slavery, but Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington built over 5,000 schools to educate black folks after slavery. And I was one of them, and out of those 5,000 schools right now, only two of them remain. Ours,
wow,
and one in Arkansas. And so those are points of history. Those are monuments to the people that came before us. You know, you hear people talking about statues and saving statues and stuff like that. Well, a statue is a monument. That's, you look in the dictionary, it says a statue is a monument, first sentence. And see, we have monuments that needs to be saved. Africa Town is a monument to the last shipment of slaves that came over here, community that they started. And they were babies. They brought over 108 made it. And the youngest one was two and the oldest one was 26, them babies. And they brought them over here butt naked, 2.5 month trip. They couldn't speak any English. Got here in 1860, and by 18, they were set free in 1865. So their mentality, especially those ones over the age of 10, their mentality was not in slavery. It was in freedom. Like one of the folklores in Africa Town goes, the old slave from generations, when they set him free, he said, I don't know nothing about freedom. If I don't slave, how am I going to eat? And then and the guy from the Clotilda told him, said, look, I was on a slave for 5 years. I know more about being free than being a slave. You follow me. Y'all got all those deals over there in Hall Bayou. They think they fast, but you let me get hungry. And I'll catch them. And when I was 10 years old, they put a spear in my hand, told me to kill a lion. And that lion was trying to eat me. And I killed him. Over there, how about y'all? Y'all got fish, y'all got coon, y'all got squirrels, y'all got rabbits, y'all got fish. The guy said, well, yeah, Joe, but over the Hall Bayou, they got these big old alligators. And Joseph said, yeah, that's right, we're gonna eat them suckers too. So they had a different mentality. And so they got here, they were butt naked, 10 years, didn't speak no English, but 10 years later, they had acquired the ability and wherewithal and made the right contacts with people. And they incorporated the land because they wanted their own land. They knew what ownership of land meant. And so that's how the community began to grow, because others from other areas began to come down here because they said, you know, let's see what these people are doing down here. They're doing something special. And so they began to come into the area. And then when International Scots moved in the area, and they said, well, anybody, sound-minded body, want to work and you live in Africa Town, we're going to hire you. And so everybody came and packed in the community. And next thing you know, we were up to 10,000-12,000 people. But then because of the EPA and they forced International Paper and Scott to close down, and then another big industry of Air Force Base closed down, and those are three biggest industries in the city and the county. Each one of them had about 6,000 employees. And so a lot of people moved away, including a lot of people from Africatown, you know, following those jobs. So, and then things just went downhill from there. But the main thing you got to remember is that they got here in 1860. They incorporated the town in their own corporation in 1870, 10 years. In 1960, 100 years after they got here, they turned themselves over to the city because they wanted to get better. All the streets was paved, was dirt roads. You were getting water out of the well. You had an outhouse right here going into the ground. And they had international paper and skies around the corner polluting into the ground. And so the city of Mobile made a pitch for them, say, y'all come to us, we'll give you water, sewer, and pave your street. Now, they wanted those taxes, see. Those big industries were sitting out there in the county, paying county taxes, but they weren't paying no city tax. They wanted those taxes. And so the people voted to become part of Mobile in 1960. And they did pave the streets, get water and sewer. And they even built a housing project to alleviate the overcrowding in the community. And so that was 1960 when they became part of the city. And then 1970 is probably what I call when true desegregation began in the city of in Mobile. And that's when Africatown began to slip away from us. The city began rezoning stuff and, you know, trying to replace the mills that were being moved, had been moved out. And so, and it was about 10 years after that before the citizens and residents figured out what was going on. And so that struggle began around 1970. And so I got back in 75. So I watched things go down until my mother gave me a mission, and I've been on that mission ever since.
Your mama sounds like a very wise woman. And she sounds a lot like my Nana. My Nana has the suck it up buttercup mentality and, you know, tough titty said the kitty, but the milk's still good. That's her mentality. Yeah, you got to hit the ground running.
Yeah, she took those two COVID shots and her arm didn't even get sore. She
not oh, my goodness. Oh, I'm so glad that she's vaccinated, too. That was amazing. Thank you so much, Mr. Joe. So something that kind of is sticking to me, since this is an episode about air, essentially, is like Africatown seems to, I've never been. I want to now. If anything, there needs to be like, I don't know if there's a museum there dedicated to everything.
We're just beginning. It's interesting. The citizens of Mobile have been talking to the city for a long time. Now, I said I wasn't doing anything, but I did go to a few of those meetings down there with the councilman. And they always complain, we need to be a tourist attraction. We need to be a tourist. Mm-hmm. And the big thing was they wanted a welcome center. And so with the BP fines that was, after the BP oil rig thing, me and my buddy did get together and put a request in. And it was granted to build a welcome center, $3.5 million. But that's not going to be enough. But I think the city is taking that project, and there's still some money left. So they should be able to get that job done. In the meantime, our county commissioner representative, Ms. Lovegood, she's thrown in most of the money to be over known as a heritage house within the community to house artifacts, especially artifacts that they're going to be bringing up from the flotilla, the boat that they found. And that's scheduled to go up before the end of this year.
Yeah, wasn't that?
Yeah. And so that's we sort of targeted that at the beginning of tourism for Africatown.
Yeah, wasn't that ship found in like 2019? Like very recent.
Right. It was found in 2019. There have been a couple of searches for it in the past, but they've got better equipment now and so they got the right people involved to find the ship, people from the National Smithsonian and Slave Wrecks Project. And they took them a couple of turns to find it, but they found it.
That's so cool. But what I was going to say is that it seems like this, I mean, like you said, the city, your community has such a rich, deep history to it. But these industries have kind of polluted the heck of it, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yes, we know about that because we lived through it. But see, mm-hmm. the thing is, when we first started looking into that, we went to the EPA, we went to the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, we went to the local city environment folks, and we went to the Corps of Engineers. No one had any records.
Hmm.
So no one, if you walk around Africatown, you don't see no sign that says warning, pollution. So if somebody tell you that the water is not polluted, then you're going to go in there and swim in it.
Or eat the fish.
Yeah. So that's the, either you tell me it's polluted or you tell me it's not. You know, that's your job. You tell me, you do your job. Is it polluted mm-hmm. or is it not polluted? If it's polluted, then put up some signs and then clean it up. And that's what we're in the process of doing right now. The city has put in for and three brownfield grants have been approved for three spots in Africatown, and two of those spots is along what we call a blue way that we're creating along the river, around the waterway, and with a brownfield you have three phases basically. First, each one of these brownfield was approved for $100,000 for phase one. So you go in there and you analyze the stuff, the water, the dirt, air, and you find out whether or not it's harmful. Then you find out it is harmful, then you put in for another brownfield grant to clean it up. And then even after that, you can put in for another brownfield grant to construct something on it and make it better. So you can clean, you can find out if it's harmful, clean it up, then construct something on the site. And then that's what we're in the process of doing right now. It's gonna take some time. You know, this mm-hmm. thing didn't happen overnight, and we realized that. So that's one thing we'll do. We've got various organizations, and those organizations are wrapped around basically three themes. One of the themes involves education. That's our school. That's one of the school and the churches are the hub of the community. That's the thing that everybody can agree on. And then we've got organizations such as mine, the one I'm involved, that's a couple of organizations, one called MEJAC, another one called CHESS. And our job basically is to promote and protect the environment and educate the people on what's going on surrounding the environment. And then number three is the renovation of the community.
That's really cool. What do CHESS and MEJAC stand for?
Okay, MEJAC, actually, we organized that around 2013 when they were trying to build storage tanks in and around the community and rezone some stuff and bring tar sands all into Mobile. MEJAC stands for Mobile Environmental Justice Action Coalition. And that key word to me is coalition, because it was the first time that a group of blacks, white, Native Americans, and even some business folk people had gotten together and that to fight for the environment. Because one thing that they were doing with this pipeline was, and they ended up doing it, but it was a fight to try to, we didn't let it go easily. They took the pipeline wreck through our drinking water. Yeah, right through an area of Big Creek Lake, which is the reservoir for drinking water from Mobile County. And that's when we found out that we asked Quay, what if this pipe leaks? What's the backup? Well, the backup to the drinking water in Mobile is the Mobile River. Mobile River, and that's the Mobile River is not what it used to be. Used to be a lot of crabs and fish and shrimps and stuff like that. And with this chemical corridor they have coming down the Mobile, the northern part of Mobile River, where they already have all these chemicals coming. It's just changed. It's changed the water itself. Used to see a bunch of oyster boats and shrimp boats out there in the Mobile Bay. You don't see that anymore. those things have moved on.
Well, yeah, you don't want the fish from this nasty water, you know?
I remember coming up, they used to close the bay pretty frequently when they first built this chemical quarter, because they said that the mercury level in the water was so high. And so, things have changed. But that coalition was the key moment. We had never seen nothing like that before, and it was a surprise, and it was a good surprise. People working together to get something done. CHEST I organized around 2017, and it specifically only operates in Africatown. The MEJAC is Mobile County, the entire county, but CHEST is simply Africatown, and we don't go outside of the boundaries, and we try to. Our goal primarily is to educate the residents, motivate the residents about things that are happening within the community that they should know about, policies and procedures that the elected politicians are or are not doing in favor of the community, or not telling people. We were basically, well, before COVID, yeah, we were holding Monday community meeting. People were packed, 150, 200 people. And then we, you know, talked about what was going on, what we were planning to do, what the city weren't doing. And then, of course, after that, about an hour and a half meeting, we fed everybody. So everybody went on happy. And so that's the primary thing that CHEST has to do. Plus, CHEST keeps up with current events surrounding things such as the highway system, because that's been a problem. The Port of Mobile, we sit right here in the mouth of the port. We right here, right on the same water. On the other side, they're on the other side pretty much, but even got stuff on this side. And industrial stuff, because the industries are always trying to get us to rezone property in Africatown where no one lives. They figure, if you don't live there, then you don't care about it. So give it to me. And so we're steadily fighting those battles. And we have to stay on our toes, because if we don't, they'll sneak stuff in on us. And so that's why we have to be aware of it. And, you know, we don't catch everything, but we do as much as we can.
Well, I mean, and like you said about knowing your enemy and stuff earlier, when it comes to fighting people, I think y'all are doing a really good job about that. And, you know, they try to keep people in the dark. They don't want people to know.
They don't. That was a guy who's a friend of my granddad, so I got to know him quite well, because they used to work on special projects around the community. Yeah, they were sort of hand in hand. And his name was Henry Williams. And we used to call him the Godfather of Africa. Now, he was the only one that really used to talk about the last shipment of slaves. And he wrote two or three books. And but one thing that I remember he used to say all the time was, after slavery ended and the slave was set free, Tim the mayor, who's the man that bought him over, allowed them to purchase his land to live on. It was their land, they purchased it legally, they had paperwork and everything. But after Tim the mayor died, his descendants and others have been trying to get them off that property by any means necessary.
Oh, wow.
And that goes on today.
Is it because of all the industries there, like the pollution?
It's because
and stuff?
Of all the industry there. They left a lot of land. And then they make a lot of, they have a land trust, big land trust called Chippewa Lakes. You see a sign in Mobile saying Chippewa Lake, that's the mayor family. And so they have people that run that trust. And so the people that run the trust make money off the land, you know. And so everybody's making money off the land. Matter of fact, I've been told that the mayor family owns, is the second largest land owner in the state of Alabama, you know, family owned, about 500,000 acres of land. That's a lot of land up and down the Kennesaw River Delta. But they used to be lumbermen. They had a sawmill. And they just go up there and cut their lumber down and bring it down the river, you know, and cut it up and sell it. And so they Africatown is about 5 square miles, but like I said, most of the land around Africatown is surrounded by mill property, and then they steadily trying to industrialize stuff and to make money. And part of the rumor we had was that the Mayer family owned Mobile and Pritchard before Mobile and Pritchard became Mobile and Pritchard. I think they purchased a lot of their land right after the Louisiana Purchase.
Oh.
Yeah, so we got it for a little or nothing.
Yeah. Well, you know, committing genocide against so many people.
Yeah.
Good grief. So this is a land issue. This is a water issue.
That's why we have to have a lot of organization, because you can't, it's hard to deal with them all. And so that's why we had to reach out for help from anywhere anywhere we can get it, people that were able-bodied that can help. I'm talking about the people that know the law, people that know various issues. And we are finding ways to bring in money too. We did get $50,000 from the National Trust to hire an executive director, and we're still working on setting that up. That person, when they come in, gonna have to hit the ground running, because there are a lot of different things going on. Trust me, there's a lot of different things going on in this community that have to be attended to. And especially with home renovation. Home renovation is big. And we sort of recently, we've been thinking about doing this because we had to set up the corporation, but we recently got some help from an organization out of New Orleans. And right now we're renovating 5 homes all at once.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, all at once. And we're going to get some more money to renovate some more. Our goal is to try to see if we can renovate about at least 25 homes a year. You know, that's even a small number. But when you look at what Africatown was put on National Historical Register in 2012, that's been 9 years. And when you look around the community, not much has been done.
Yeah.
And most people have been putting their trust into the city to get things done, but nothing's been done. Even with the Welcome Center, me and my buddies, we put in to get that money. And now we got the grant for this, but there's some folks in the county that are working with us. But when you look at Africatown itself, they're basically, when you look at the land, we got about 300 houses in the community that put us on National Historical Register. About 300 houses. Now, with those houses, when you start repairing, you can't really do a lot to the framework. You know, you can't go in with aluminum siding, because if you change pretty much the way it looks a whole lot, you lose that house. It falls off the national register. And if you lose about 40% of your houses, they take you off the register. So we got to make sure that that doesn't happen. So when the city came in and said, well, we're going to help you with blight. And then their study came out, well, you got a lot of old houses, we're going to tear them down. We said, wait a minute. We can fix those houses. So we got some houses that we're renovating. People live in them. We're renovating, and then we got a lot of vacant lots where people have just moved out, torn down their house, or even the city tore down some old houses. And so old houses, those vacant lots, are really opportunities, and that's where the design competition come in, as you mentioned. Those old houses are really opportunities for renewal within the community. So you got historical homes, vacant lots, and then you got houses that are there and they really need to, you have to decide what you're gonna do. Try to restore, fix them up, or tear them down and put something in there new. And so those are three things that we have to work on and do right within the community. We think that with the space available, now I tell you that right now the community is about 2,000 people. We think that with the space available, we can get the community back up to about 6,000 people. Now, people come in there all the time looking for houses, especially to rent. You know, young people in their 20s with young kids don't have a lot of money, but they want to place to stay. And they know the community is quiet. It's almost like a retirement community. And so, but they don't have really anywhere to stay, you know, no houses to rent. So that's what we got to work out.
Yeah, so are you weatherizing the houses? Is that what the renovations are?
That's basically.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I just want to make sure.
If you go around the community, you see a lot of blue tops.
Mm.
A lot of blue tops. So when we had the crew to come in and start working on these various houses, first thing they did, they're working on the outside, and then they work on, they try to do what they can on the inside that they messed up. And so, you know, people saw all this happening. And one of the key people in that department is a pastor of one of our churches, Reverend William in Yorktown. And so next thing he noticed, people were calling him at 3 o'clock in the morning. How can I get on your list? So he got a long list he's accumulated. And before we did this, though, we purchased tarps. We got some tarps. And I had people calling me at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Joe, it's raining. Come put my tarp up.
Oh, no.
There are a lot of good people with some, you know, some problem with their house. And most of them, you wouldn't even know it if you didn't see the blue tarp up there.
Good grief. Man. Well, Joe, I could listen to you talk for hours and hours and hours. But for the sake of time, I wanted to close out with this question. Since y'all are dealing with so many intersecting issues, whether it comes to pollution, when it comes to renovating houses, anything like that, what is something that gives you hope at the end of the day? Like, what keeps you fighting?
My mother. If I give up, she'll whip me. I'm 70 years old, and there are two people around that'll whip me, and I'll let them. That's my mother and God.
Yeah.
And so, but the other thing that keeps me going are the people in the community that they're very good people. They're very good people, and you don't mind, you know, lending a hand. And the community itself, it needs to be saved, and it deserves to be treated right. The community, the people deserve to be treated right. And like I tell a lot of people, it's unfortunate that when you look at this thing, the people that bought the last shipment of slaves over to this country are the same people we're fighting right now, and that shouldn't be that way.
Mm-hmm. Seems like the same game, but different players.
Same game, different player. That's right.
Mm. Well,
we believe that if we're successful, and we will be successful, it might take some time to be mm-hmm. fully successful, that the prototype that we established here in Africatown can be used elsewhere in other cities around the country, maybe even around the world, for getting things done. And it takes a collaborative effort and buy-in from people that want to see something get done.
I love that. I think y'all's community is an inspiration and will be an inspiration. I mean, the whole purpose of this podcast is to show that we got something to say in the South, and we deserve to be at the table. So thank you so much, Joe. I really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Climate Justice Y'all podcast. My name is Michael Hansen, and I'm the executive director of a small nonprofit organization called GASP in Birmingham, Alabama. We're one of the four organizations who came together to produce this podcast. The other groups are the Southeast Climate and Energy Network, the Gulf Coast Center for Law and Policy, and the People's Justice Council. We're centering the stories of the people and places on the front lines of the climate crisis and environmental justice movements in the South. We'll be talking about air, energy, land, labor, democracy, and all kinds of other issues affecting Southern communities. Funding for this podcast was provided in part by the U.S. Climate Action Network. If you'd like to see this work continue, please consider making a donation on our website. If your organization or company would like to sponsor an episode, please get in touch with us by emailing me at michael@gaspgroup.org. That's Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, @gaspgroup.org. Thanks again for listening and being a part of this story.